Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau, of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our guest this week, Thomas Fleming, has written a book that challenges many of our long-held assumptions concerning President Woodrow Wilson and his actions in World War I. The title of his book, just to give you a hint, is The Illusion of Victory. Fleming will be here in a moment to explain. And after that, staying on the subject of war, Bevan Alexander returns to Talking History to offer us his thoughts on how the world has experienced a military revolution in the past decade and what impact that revolution has had on how wars are fought. But first, Joey Skidmore takes us back to an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on February 16, 1959, Fidel Castro was sworn in as Cuba's prime minister after fighting a bloody guerrilla war against the right-wing forces of Fulgencio Batista. Castro became involved in revolutionary politics while a student. He fought alongside exiled Dominicans to overthrow Dominican dictator Rafael Trujillo, and in 1948 he joined urban rioters in Bogota, Colombia. Castro's hopes for elected office in Cuba were dashed when Batista seized power in a coup d'état in 1951. Opposition groups rose against Batista, and on July 23, 1953, Castro led a group of 160 rebels in an attack on Cuba's second-largest military base, Moncada Barracks. Castro was defeated, captured, and sentenced to 15 years in prison. 2 years later, Batista freed all political prisoners, and Castro and his brother Raúl went to Mexico, where they formed the revolutionary 26th of July movement and joined forces with Argentinian Marxist Che Guevara. In their attacks on the Batista regime, the revolutionaries at first suffered great losses, but by mid-1958, with increased peasant support, the scales tipped in Castro's favor. Batista fled on January 1, 1959, and on February 16, Fidel Castro became Cuba's prime minister.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, D.M. Giangreco and Catherine Moore have provided us with a brief history of the Purple Heart. In an article in American Heritage magazine, they explain that it began as the badge of military merit in 1782. General George Washington needed a way around congressional unwillingness to reward ordinary soldiers for extraordinary deeds. The tradition had been to present decorations only to officers. Regular soldiers were honored with promotions, but as money dwindled, Washington found Congress unwilling to approve such promotions. Washington's answer was the badge of military merit for singularly meritorious action, extraordinary fidelity, and essential service. Washington created the figure of a heart of purple cloth or silk edged with a narrow lace of binding and stipulated that it be worn over the left breast. The decoration fell into disuse after the Revolutionary War, but it was revived by General Douglas MacArthur during World War II and renamed the Purple Heart. This is Talking History.
You're one of Uncle Sammy's boys. You have no use for any noise. You've won every Yankee heart from coast to coast. Greater than a flag. You're the world's great mediator of you. This whole United States can boast. We trust you with any kind of love. We're glad you belong to us. We take our hats off to you, Mr. Wilson. Our hats are off to you. You're the man of the hour. Like a tower, you knew what to do for the red, white, and blue. You're the right kind of man in the right kind of place. Like Washington and Lincoln, you set a pace. Say no at home and abroad. Your pen is greater than the sword. We take our hat off to you.
Our guest this week, Thomas Fleming, is one of the nation's most highly regarded and prolific historians, with more than 40 books to his name on subjects from Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr to the New Deal. The Illusion of Victory, however, Fleming's latest book, may become his most controversial. It's a highly critical look at President Woodrow Wilson's handling of the First World War that substantially revises how most of us have viewed Wilson and American involvement in the Great War. Welcome, Tom.
I'm delighted to be with you, Brian.
Well, thank you for joining us. Why the illusion of victory, the phrase you use in your title? Are you suggesting that the Allies were not victorious?
I'm suggesting that America was not victorious. Certainly the Allies weren't either, except in a very literal sense. The war destroyed the French, and the British weren't in much better shape. But for the Americans, it was a crushing experience, a demoralizing experience, because Wilson went in claiming that we were going to be the nation that brought peace to the whole world. Instead, his whole experience was that of repudiation at the peace conference after the war, and also then repudiation by the Senate. And finally, and this is what I think most people forget, Brian, is he was repudiated in 1920 by the American people. Wilson said that the peace conference, the peace treaty, and the League of Nations were the great issue. That was the burning issue of the election of 1920. And the two Democratic candidates both accepted this, and they made that the main issue, and the Democrats lost in one of the greatest landslides in American history.
Well, you suggest in the book that, you know, much of the reasoning for these repudiations had to do with serious errors that Wilson made as president. Can you tell us what the most serious errors were?
I think that it dawned on the American people as they looked back on the experience that the worst error was Wilson kept saying, we're neutral, but we weren't neutral. It was a sham neutrality. The British and the French, by 1916, were getting 40% of all the war material, the shells, the bullets, everything you can think of that they used. They were getting that from the United States. The British were paying for everything. Of the £5 million England spent on the war each day, £2 million, that's $70 million a week, were spent in the United States. That computes to $96 million a week in 2002 dollars. So you realize that we were never neutral. And it dawned on people that we were deluded by Wilson when he kept saying this.
How much was due to his military or perhaps his political inexperience?
I think a good deal of it was due to that. He, after all, had only been in politics. He'd been governor of New Jersey from 1910 to 1912, and then president from 1912. He'd only been in politics 7 years when we went into the war. Before that, he was president of Princeton, which at that time, incidentally, was not considered a very important college. The British ambassador, who hated Wilson, incidentally, recalled it a little country college, which, of course, would drive most Princetonians mad today.
Yeah, I hope they're not listening to the show.
But it was definitely really severe political inexperience that caused a lot of his mistakes. He didn't know how to deal politically with the people, the politicians in America. He tended to have grudges and pick fights with people when they disagree with him. They turned them into personal enemies. And he also was very much tended, I think, to buy what the British and the French were saying as if it was necessarily true.
So are you saying that the decisions were wrong or that he was just politically inept in getting them accepted by those around him?
The decisions weren't wrong. His first term president, as a matter of fact, is considered a high point of the presidency. He got a lot of reform measures through Congress. He created the Federal Reserve and changed the child labor laws. He did a lot of very good things, but they were all domestic. Meanwhile, this gigantic black cloud sat on the horizon, the world war that was raging in Europe. And Wilson's attempt to deal with that was where he was totally out of his depth.
Okay. Well, successful in the first term, but he was elected in the second term. You mentioned this dark cloud.
Yes.
But his slogan was, he kept us out of war. Now, then he promptly went to war. So
yes.
Are we talking about another example of deception and electioneering, that he lied to get us into the war? What's going on here?
No, I don't think that Wilson consciously lied at all. That was not his slogan. It was invented by some Democratic politician, you know, but he never repudiated it. So he more or less ran on it. So, but he thought that once he was reelected, he would have the power to propose a peace without victory, which he gave a speech with that title not long after he was reelected. Again, he was incredibly naive. He had no concept of the enormous hatred that had been brewed between these two antagonists over in Europe, and of all things, to say that he was going to help them broker a peace without victory, that drove the British and the French right up the wall. They were calling this a moral war, a war against an evil enemy, and here's Wilson saying, oh, we were all equal as far as I'm concerned.
Interesting. Well, then how did he persuade the Americans, who weren't exactly anxious to go to war in the first place, to make war?
He had an enormous ability as an orator. Wilson was one of the great oratorical presidents. He had honed this skill for long, long years, both as in his academic career and in his political career. And the speech that he gave to Congress on April 2nd, 1917, calling for war, was a masterpiece. There's no question about it. He played on every emotion that Americans had, especially, he used that term, to make the world safer democracy. That was an idealistic purpose that really stirred Americans all across, in both parties, I think. And the irony, of course, is that it was a phrase that the British had invented.
Interesting. Well, you mentioned naivete. You mentioned he made mistakes. How much did the French and the British perhaps dupe Wilson into entering the war?
That is, I think, the true tragedy of America's entrance into World War I. We did not know what we were getting into. Wilson, only several weeks before he declared war, or he called on Congress to declare war, told a delegation that came to the White House that we were going to declare war for only one reason, because that would entitle him to a seat at the peace conference. He thought that the Americans were winning the war. And when he sent an officer from the War Department up to Congress for a huge appropriation of $3 billion right after war was declared by Congress, the head of the Senate Democratic Party said, well, what do you need all that money for? And among other things, the officer said, oh, well, we might have to send an army to Europe. And the senator said, the leader of the Democratic Party in the Senate now said, oh, my Lord, you're not going to send soldiers over there, are you?
Right. And you even go beyond duping. You even say, once we did get into the war, that the Allies really turned the American Expeditionary Force into cannon fodder.
They definitely tried. Thank goodness we had a general, John J. Pershing, who was one tough cookie. But a month after Wilson declared war, thinking that the British and the French had the war as good as won, delegations from the British and the French arrived in Washington, and the first thing they said was, we want men, men, men. And they revealed that the French army had mutinied only a few weeks earlier, and there was only one division they could depend on. The British were reeling from unbelievably stupendous casualties in the Battle of the Somme the previous year, 600,000 casualties. What they wanted the Americans to do was draft men and ship them to England, where they'd be trained and marched into the British army. And the French wanted us to do the same thing, except they said, well, we have a language barrier, so you can train them here and ship them over, but then we'll put them in the French army. But fortunately, John J. Pershing said no, 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 and he persuaded Wilson to go along with him. Wilson was not sure whether they ought to do it. But it was Pershing's vehement opposition to this that finally convinced him.
Now, at the end of the war, and you made reference to this earlier, the Allies are very, they mock Wilson, there's no other way to put it, in his ideals. And then when he gets back to the United States, he's abandoned nearly by Congress because they refused to ratify U.S. membership in the League of Nations.
Yes.
What went wrong on both ends?
Many things. Again, it was Wilson's assumption that an idealistic slogan or a whole set of slogans. He gave this very, very soaring and idealistic speech called, which is usually called the 14 points. He laid down 14 points that would assure the peace of the world, like freedom of the seas and a self-determination, which was an incredibly loaded term. He didn't realize it at the time. And so when he got to France, to the Paris Peace Conference, he found out that, for instance, Premier Clemenceau said, God Almighty was satisfied with 10 commandments, but Wilson wants 14. They really laughed in his face. And the Prime Minister of England had been reelected in a post-war, parliamentary election. He had run on the slogan, "Make the Hun pay." So these were the characters that Wilson was dealing with, talking about idealistic peace without victory. We're going to be friends with the Germans and heal the wounds of the war. These guys wanted revenge. They wanted money. They wanted to reduce Germany to total impotence. And here's what we forget, Brian. The Germans negotiated with Wilson, not with the other countries. And Wilson, without truly consulting these people, he did send a representative over to make sure they theoretically agreed with his 14 points, but he more or less agreed with the Germans that they could negotiate peace on the basis of the 14 points, and that in the course of the peace conference became one of the biggest jokes. There was a newsman who kept track of how each one of the 14 points was discarded as the peace conference went on, and he wrote mocking articles about it.
And what about Congress? Why did they reject membership in the League?
When Wilson got back to the United States, the liberals in Congress were horrified by this travesty of the peace treaty that he said he was going to negotiate. Senator La Follette of Wisconsin, he called it a spoils-grabbing compact of greed and hate. On the other side of the aisle, the conservatives were very upset because the League of Nations, as Wilson drew it up, would require the United States to surrender its sovereignty, its right to decide when to go to war and when not to. And the leader of the Republicans, Henry Cabot Lodge, thought this was an absolutely awful idea. He thought we could never send Americans to war unless they were truly convinced that the country as a whole wanted to go. And Wilson would not compromise on this. In fact, that was once more his worst weakness as a politician. He wouldn't compromise with anybody about this. And he fought them. He mocked them. He called the senators people with bungalow minds. And this got in the newspapers, believe it or not. This was a great way to get people to agree with you, to insult them in public. And so finally he went on a speaking tour around the country to try to rally the people on his side. And he suffered a cerebral thrombosis in the middle of the tour. And he was a mental and physical cripple for the rest of his presidency.
Huh. Pretty tragic.
It's a very tragic story. It really is.
Well, we only have 2 minutes left, but why don't you comment also on your criticism of Wilson's handling of the war at home?
That is a sad story, too. He created this Committee on Public Information, which was an enormous propaganda machine, aimed nothing less than at brainwashing the American people. And simultaneously, he passed these sedition and espionage acts, which made it a crime to criticize the government. You could be thrown in jail if somebody overheard you saying, President Wilson's a bum, or he's a jerk, he doesn't know what he's doing, or this war is a waste of time. That was good for 5 or 6 years in jail.
And you don't feel that these were justified because of the war conditions?
No, there really wasn't any threat. The American people were mostly behind the war, and there was no reason to put these people in jail and to demand this unanimity, which was it was ferocious in the way they threw people in jail. They even bugged people's bedrooms and things like that. There was a group of sort of amateur Secret Service men that were empowered by the Wilson government to look for traitors and spies and disloyal Americans all over the country. And they really created a kind of mental reign of terror.
Interesting, because you clearly state in the book that all this happens in a time that's generally seen as a period of political reform.
It was in his first term, but the reforms collapsed in Wilson's second term. And the bottom line was the American people, it's a very sad thing to say, but the American people were totally disillusioned by this play to create this idealistic world order. It just was, the world wasn't ready for it, and it created a great deal of cynicism in American voters.
Well, we'll have to leave it at that very good but sad bottom line. So thanks, Tom, for being with us. It was really good.
Well, Brian, thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Okay, we'll look forward to talking to you again.
Okay.
You've been listening to Thomas Fleming, author of The Illusion of Victory, America in World War I, published by Basic Books. And this is Talking History.
The boys will soon be back on the farm. Mr. Reuben started winking and slowly rubbed his chin. He pulled his chair up close to Mother and he answered with a grin. How you gonna keep 'em down on the farm after they've seen Harry? How you gonna keep 'em away from Broadway, jumping around and thinking the town? How you gonna keep 'em away from harm that's a mystery? They'll never want to see a rake or plow, and who the deuce can call a luau? How you gonna keep 'em down on the farm after they've seen Harry?
Bevan Alexander was on our show recently to discuss his new book, How Wars Are Won. He returns this week to explain why he thinks the world has undergone a military revolution, or more specifically, a dramatic change in the weapons we use, and how those without such sophisticated weapons have responded. Alexander is a professor of history at Longwood University in Virginia.
Since 1991, the world has passed through a military revolution as profound and complete as it did in 1346, when English and Welsh foot soldiers wielded a new weapon, the longbow, which pierced the armor of French knights at Crecy. This brought about the end of the knight on horseback and feudalism, and commenced the process that led to freedom and democracy in Western Europe. The latest revolution is based on another new weapon, a vast increase in the power and effectiveness of American air power. In the 1991 Gulf War, only 10% of ordnance consisted of smart bombs. In 2003, some 90% of all bombs that dropped on Iraq were guided by inerrant means, especially the satellite-directed global positioning system, or GPS, which can deliver a bomb with great precision to virtually any point on Earth. With air supremacy, American unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs, plus satellites, helicopters, and other vehicles, can destroy any enemy force or element that shows itself, even single tanks, vehicles, and small units of men. Absolute command of the air and weapons that can strike any enemy force that shows itself have completely altered the way conventional wars can be fought. Human beings can no longer survive on the traditional battlefields as they existed in the 20th century. No enemy forces can mass against American forces, because once they appear in the open, and sometimes when they are undercover, they can be detected and destroyed. The only way enemy forces can survive is by hiding and by wide distribution over the landscape. Since no other military force can stand up against the United States, it is now clear that the principal challenge the United States will face in the foreseeable future will not be from the conventional formal armies of nation-states, but from the unconventional informal bands of non-nation-states. The process began in the attacks on the Taliban government and al-Qaeda terrorists in Afghanistan in 2001 and 2, neither of which possessed regular military forces. In Afghanistan, the forces we met were essentially guerrilla units that could only strike at isolated American elements, then disappear into the population. A similar guerrilla war erupted in Iraq soon after Saddam Hussein's government collapsed in spring 2003. In the Sinai Triangle of Baghdad, Fallujah, to Crete, enough supporters of Saddam lived to shelter guerrilla elements, permitted them to emerge to do their damage, then slip back into the population with some assurance of safety. Guerrillas can exist so long as they have active leadership and have a substantial portion of the population supporting them. If these two conditions are met, as the Chinese communist leader Mao Zedong described it in 1937, guerrillas can swim in the water of the people and not be easily detected. Guerrillas strike not at the civilians and the soldiers who are their immediate victims, but at the will of the people at home to endure the killings. When support at home vanishes, a nation fighting a guerrilla war must give up the effort. This is why the United States withdrew from Vietnam in 1973. The United States has arrived at a peculiar position. The weapons and technology that make the American military invincible in conventional warfare have virtually eliminated the possibility they will be used, except to destroy another rogue government like Iraq's. This is bringing about a new revolution. The American military is now reordering its structure to create small, guerrilla-like, rapid reaction elements to meet the new challenge of guerrillas and terrorists. Nevertheless, the virtual assurance that guerrilla warfare will erupt in any country we occupy obligates us to reach political solutions in these countries quickly and then withdraw. We must remember the lesson of Vietnam. We cannot solve political problems by military means.
You've been listening to Bevan Alexander, military historian and the author of How Wars Are Won. And finally, we leave you once again with words from the past. As we did last week, we're offering you excerpts from a collection of secret White House recordings gathered and published by the New Press. This week we take you back to an unknown date in 1947 or 1948 and to the Oval Office and a telephone conversation between President Harry S. Truman and an unidentified person, probably a congressman. The conversation concerns universal military training and selective service, later known as the draft. Men had been drafted into the armed forces during World War II, but the procedure was terminated after the war. Truman sought to restart it, but at this point had not been successful. Truman also mentions what came to be known as the Marshall Plan for rebuilding post-war Europe, which Secretary of State George Marshall had announced publicly, but that was awaiting congressional approval as well. Again, listen carefully. Remember, this was recorded in the Oval Office over 50 years ago and never intended to be on the radio.
Well, he told me about it. And I told him that we are for universal training and selective service. And the selective service request was made the emergency was to fill in until the U.S. people be implemented. And if you can put action on selective service, it'll be exceedingly helpful with the Marshall Plan. Well, why don't you get through with the selective service then, and then go back to work on the universal training because we've got the Marshall Plan. There's no way to run about it. You've always been people talking about an agreement on that, but you have this thing close to get the most done in the least time. That's absolutely the reason. The only reason I ask for selective service is because we need the men. The occupation forces are short about 1.5 men now, and we're in a dangerous position with that thing.
You've been listening to President Harry S. Truman, courtesy of the New Press, and that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. As always, we welcome your comments, which you can send us by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.